You're listening to a CNA podcast.
This week's episode is about one of the biggest aviation mysteries of our time. On March 8, 2014, Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 took off from Kuala Lumpur for Beijing. Then suddenly, it just seemed to vanish off radar screens. Days later, the confirmation no one wanted to hear.
Flight MH370 ended in a sudden Indian Ocean.
What was supposed to be a routine 6.5-hour flight turned into a 10-year-long quest for closure. This is what it sounds like outside the Malaysian embassy in Beijing nearly every anniversary.
Malaysia!
Malaysia!
还我就下!
还我就下!
马来西亚!
马来西亚!
履行国际义务!
Family and friends calling on Malaysia to tell them the truth about what happened to all of those on board. How likely will families ever find the answers they're looking for? I'm Teresa Tang. In this episode of the CNA Correspondent Podcast, we tackle this story from Malaysia with Melissa Goh and from Beijing with Olivia Seung. A very warm welcome to the both of you.
Hi, Teresa.
You know, whenever something big happens in the news, it kind of sticks in your memory like a moment frozen in time, right? For me, I clearly recall March 2014. I was in front of a computer in London working on an assignment for a grad class that I was in when I saw this headline. And I totally remember thinking, what in the world? Are you serious? What about you guys? I'm curious to know, where were both of you when news broke 10 years ago? Mel?
I was in KL. It was a weekend. And I remember that, you know, I happened to be in the office that early morning, picking up some things that I left behind. And I got a call from office in Singapore asking me to check on a news flash that came in that a Malaysia Airlines flight gone missing like 6 hours ago. So I pick up the phone. I tried to call the airline. The line was so busy. So I decided to hop on the train and head straight to the airport to find out more. But when I got there, it was really absolute chaos already. Families, media were told to go to the airport hotel, wait there for news. No one could tell us anything. The auditorium was just being set up for news conferences. And I caught the first PC by the Department of Civil Aviation and by the airline, and they confirmed that they have lost all contact with MH370. It was really bizarre because by then the plane had gone missing for 10 hours. Mm-hmm. Then the ministers started to arrive, the army, the navy chiefs, the police chiefs. The whole place was so busy and crowded after that. The auditorium was like our home for the next 2 weeks. Sometimes there were just 3 or 4 news conferences, but with very little information for us to work on. They gave us bits and pieces, and you could see them scrambling to piece together. It's just like a jigsaw puzzle.
Olivia, what about you?
Well, I remember it was a weekend, like Mel said, and I was at home in Singapore with my family, and we had the TV on when the news came in. And I just remember thinking that this is so surreal that a plane could disappear. And then I remember we had the TV on throughout the day because it was just quite unimaginable. I watched Mel on air and other colleagues in the weeks that followed. And for myself, last year, when the court hearings for the Chinese families began in November, it really struck me. You know, the news cycle goes on, and after the initial frenzy of it, other headlines come in and there are other news items. But then these families that we were interviewing, this is their reality for the last decade. And many of them that we had been speaking to had tears in their eyes when they told me, you know, I just want my family members to come back. I believe that they are still alive. And that was something that for me and my cameraman, we had to pause and really just take in as well.
Mel, the Malaysian government, they've been under enormous pressure since day one to get to the bottom of this, and they largely have taken responsibility for this investigation. Can you take us back to that day and the years since in terms of the sort of resources officials have been pouring into this search?
Well, it is described as one of the biggest and probably the most expensive search operation in history. It involves so many parties. At one point, Malaysia was coordinating hundreds of assets from air to sea from 26 countries. All wanted to help, even though their nationals weren't on board. everyone just want to hop on and help. First, they were combing the South China Sea because that was the last place. I mean, the MH370 disappeared from the radar screens shortly after Malaysia air traffic control handed over to Vietnam. And then the search expanded and to Straits of Malacca and all the way to the Andaman Sea because the military radar apparently picked up signals from an unidentified aircraft. But the army chief said they weren't sure what it was because there was no distress signal if indeed go missing. That was what they say 5 days after that it went missing. And that went on for days before finally we were told that the plane landed in the southern Indian Ocean. Indeed, it's something never happened before in history, never happened before in Malaysia. And according to the former defense minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, whom I spoke with back then, he was the acting transport minister. He said that Malaysia has tried its level best and should not be faulted in any way for its response, which some described, especially the family members, it was just too slow and too incompetent. Let's take a listen.
From the first day, it's a roller coaster ride, you know. If you're talking about 14 different nationals on the plane, if you're talking about 26 nations involved in the SAR operations, it is a major task for a small country like Malaysia to coordinate.
Olivia, there were 239 passengers and crew on board MH370, and of them, 153 were Chinese nationals. Can you explain that? Why were there so many of them on board on that particular flight? And what was the reaction like in China when news broke of the plane's disappearance?
Well, from what we know, some of the passengers were on board after returning from holidays with friends, others from a business trip or to settle visa matters. The flight route is from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing and takes about 5 to 6 hours. It's this red-eye flight leaving just after midnight and it saves time. I know Mel and I were chatting and Mel has been on this same flight before, right?
Yeah, it's a red-eye flight. You slept through, basically. When you get there at 6 a.m. in the morning for daybreak. Therefore, I think a lot of passengers were probably sleeping at that time, midnight, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, speaking to some of the family members of those who are on board when they sit, that they received the call that something had happened to the plane, they described it as that they were just shell-shocked when they heard the news. And many then proceeded to this holding area or support center for family members at the Lido Hotel in Beijing, and that's where officials from Malaysia Airlines and from the Malaysian Embassy were and would eventually speak to families. And one family member I spoke to, he described it to me as being hell on earth, you know, hearing the tears, the outpouring, and just the anguish and anxiety from the family members. He said it's something that he would never forget. And many of the family members would end up camping out, staying there overnight for a good 2 months and not wanting to leave that room, that holding room and holding area out of fear that they would miss any new information. Of course, all the media had been at that hotel as well, trying to find out new information. Well, I also interviewed 67-year-old Mr. Lee Eryo, whose son was on the flight. He was an engineer, had a bright future, and had been sent to Malaysia to work on a project. But he had to travel back to Beijing to settle his work visa matters. And that's when he boarded MH370. And since then, this is how Mr. Lee has coped with the loss of his son. Have a listen.
I am just an old farmer. Before the incident, I haven't even heard of the name like Weibo, including this computer. I have developed some habits of keeping a diary in the past 10 years. I have written more than 2,000 poems. They have also been recognized by these journalists. They say that this is the true expression of the soul. Why have I persisted with Weibo or TikTok all these years? The biggest motivation of TikTok is to get more people to pay attention to this matter and ultimately urge the Malaysian government to restart the search for MH370 and find the whereabouts of my child.
Olivia, Mr. Lee's son, worked for China tech firm ZTE, and besides, you know, writing poems, he and his wife went to the company's headquarters in person for 3 months, trying to get them to take some sort of action. Can you tell us about those efforts?
Yeah, so we met Mr. Lee and his wife in Shenzhen, and spend time with them as they went about their day. Shenzhen is this big metropolis city in the south of China, and Mr. Li and his wife, they are rural farmers from the north of China in Hebei province. So it is a long way from home, and every morning they would take the train from the hotel to the ZTE headquarters to meet with staff there, as he believes that they should be compensated for the loss of his son, who was sent to Malaysia on a work trip and had to board MH370. And on some other days, he says they would visit other government departments, look for legal advice. And you can really see it's been a roller coaster of emotions for them. At some point, he also did say that they did not know what they could do next. And Mr. Li has spent all his money and even got loans from his friends to continue their efforts in the past, even to go to, for example, Madagascar, when there had been news that perhaps plane debris had been found. And so I asked Mr. Li, why are you doing this now and why are you so persistent? And his answer really struck me. He said during the 3 years of the pandemic, he did a lot of thinking about what life was meant to be about. And he said that it was really tough and they weren't able to travel from Hebei to other parts of China and then because of the strict travel restrictions. And he said that he believed that he wanted to turn the page on this episode, and he believed that his son would want him to lead a good life and to enjoy life now. But then he said he didn't realize that it was going to be so difficult to turn the chapter, because even things like closing bank accounts or seeking compensation, he's met many roadblocks, and even having to get a death certificate, which he still believes there is hope in perhaps finding his son. That's something extremely difficult for them to do. He also hasn't been able to come to an agreement with ZTE. We should point out that we have reached out to ZTE for their response to this, but they have not responded to our queries. And speaking to other Chinese family members as well, you know, there is this other man called Jiang Hui, who has become the de facto spokesperson for Chinese families, and he organizes them to, you know, go to KL for the memorial events, and he's become the spokesperson and face in front of the media. He also talked about the difficulties. He has not been working since the incident happened. He believes he lost his job because he became too prominent as a result of standing up and speaking to the media. But he says it feels like he's in a bit of limbo, especially during festivals like Qingmingjie, which is a tomb-sweeping festival. And that's a time where many go and pay respects to their dead loved ones. But he feels he's unable to do that, feels it's not right, because there is no tomb, so to speak, of his mother who was on the flight that he can go to pay his respects. And he feels it's not right as well, because there is no confirmation. He feels that she has passed. At the same time, he feels it's not right to not remember her. And so he is persisting in his search.
It feels like there is one consolation, though, knowing that there are other families who are going through the same thing. And Mel, you know, these individual families in China, they've grown to form sort of one large family in a way, bonded by this grief and a common goal. How have those in Malaysia approached authorities?
You know, it's the same thing. Each time the anniversary approaches, it's another emotional roller coaster ride for them. Now, there were 38 Malaysian passengers and 12 crew members. There's a family group that I know of, and they're still active. They stay together, stay in touch. Even during the pandemic, during the subsequent lockdowns, they kept in touch. Now, helping each other, finding closure was never easy, but they couldn't bury their loved ones. Like Olivia said, they couldn't say goodbye. There's no proper goodbye. Although some have moved on to focus on their families, their job, their career, but they haven't given up. The victims will not be forgotten. MH370, they are still hoping they will be found one day. I caught up with Jaquita. Her husband was the in-flight supervisor, Patrick Gomez, and has been with Malaysia Airlines for more than 3 decades. She really hopes that the government will give it another go, resume the search for MH370. She knows it's costly. It's probably, you know, will take a lot of resources. At a time like Malaysia government is so stretched now, you know, with ringgit all-time low and all. But she just hopes that just give it a go. Who knows? This year may be the year that MH370 is uncovered. If it's indeed in the bottom of the sea, she wants to see it.
Olivia, legal action is also one option, but some families told you that that's just not something they want to take on. Why not? Why don't they consider that?
Well, perhaps if we were to talk first about the perspective of the families taking a legal action, there are about 40 of them. They are suing Malaysia Airlines, aircraft manufacturer Boeing, engine maker Rolls-Royce, and Insurer Alliance. They have a few demands. One is for compensation, and the other is one of the main things that they say they want to see is that they restart the search for MH370. A lawyer I spoke to in Beijing said there are grounds for this and for their demands, but the issue is that the court can only determine that these parties are obligated to do something, but how to enforce that and how they can go about doing it is not something the court can do. Another thing also is that it took 7 years of preparation before these hearings began at the end of last year. And up till now, we still do not know when the outcome will be announced because of the unique nature of this case. That particular lawyer also told me that through the years, he's had some family members of the passengers on board MH370 come to him to get his advice on whether he thinks they should join this lawsuit. Some of them were in two minds about it, but some also felt like they did not want to go through the heartache of having to relive this incident and they want to move on. And his advice to them was that if it is too painful for you, then, you know, maybe consider taking the compensation and letting it go. So not an easy decision for the family members either ways.
Mel, theories abound regarding what could have happened, that the pilot deliberately took the plane off course, that there was a hijacking, a fire, it may have been shot down. You know, that list just goes on and on. But the official investigation is closed, and you pose the question of what's next to Malaysia's current transport minister. Tell us about that exchange.
Well, the Malaysia Transport Minister, Anthony Look, he is cognizant of the fact that it's been 10 years and we are nowhere closer to finding out answers for the families or solving the mystery surrounding MH370. He understands that many will continue to point fingers at the Malaysian authorities, the national carrier, Malaysia Airlines, but he wanted to stress that what happened was unprecedented. Malaysia has never dealt with anything like that before, and the authorities, you know, they have learned important, although painful lessons, he said, on how to manage crisis, how to handle the situation better, how to coordinate and communicate better. Now, while he will always make time, he said, to lend moral support to families of MH370, he won't entertain any sort of conspiracy theories or give false hope to families. They have been through enough, he said, on whether Malaysia will hear the families' pleas and resume the search. This is what he said.
The government's stand has always been very consistent. If there are credible information to be submitted to the government, then we are prepared to resume the search. But as far as we are concerned, there was yet to be any credible information that we have received so far.
Yeah, but what do you consider as credible evidence, though?
Well, this is something that at least you have to be very particular, very clear about the search area. It cannot be a general big area that you think is possible. I think that is something for our respective technical team to determine. But the moment we have any credible information and there's a proposal from this search company, Ocean Infinity, then we are prepared to resume the search.
And Mel, you've been speaking with local aviation authorities as well, and they say progress has actually been made in terms of tracking airplanes. Could something as bizarre and tragic as what happened to MH370 happen again?
Well, as far as the Department of Civil Aviation, which is now known as Civil Aviation Authority of Malaysia, is concerned, they have put in place what you called the unbreakable, which is a compliance system, a procedure to make sure there's zero fatalities in all the scheduled commercial flights. They have also moved the new facilities, the air traffic control, to KLIA, closer to where the action is. And I met the new CEO, Captain Nurazman. He's a former pilot with Malaysia Airlines for 30 years. And he told me about this compliance procedure, what's supposed to do. The radars now system has been upgraded and enhanced, overlapping. So if one is down, they can still track where the plane is. And for example, the air traffic controllers, they go through drills. They are supposed to be constantly on watch and ready to act even when no one is watching. But changing the culture, he said, is something else. It's something, it's a work in progress, it's something that Malaysia has to work on.
Olivia, did you get any sense that the Chinese resent Malaysia for what happened? Have people or political ties been affected at all since the disappearance?
I think among the Chinese families, there's definitely still some anger with regard to how Malaysian authorities handled the situation. They feel that there was misinformation or conflicting reports, and they're upset that Malaysia Airlines and the Malaysian government has stopped engaging them. Some families, they continue to visit China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs every week for the past decade in hopes of getting answers or assistance. And this is something that they have not failed to do. It stopped a bit during the pandemic, but it's something they continue to do. And this time they wrote an open letter to the Malaysian government, and they are asking to meet the Malaysian Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, and they are hoping that with this change in government that has taken place in this last 10 years, that there will be a difference in how MH370 is handled.
And before we go, Mel, let's talk about the future of Malaysia Airlines. It is not in the top 10 in terms of the Skytrax ranking, not even breaking the top 40 for that matter. But its new CEO vows to turn things around, right?
Well, it used to be. It used to be a top 10 airlines in the world, and it was the country's pride and joy. I remember when I was studying in UK in the 90s, every time, you know, before I landed in KL, every time if I step into the plane, when I'm greeted by the air stewardess, I felt home already. Before I even had the satay, I felt like I'm home. You know, that was what Malaysia Airlines for many Malaysians. So now it's 47th placing on the Skytrax ranking. Some said the flag carrier, you know, has never truly recovered from the twin tragedies in 2014. You know, remember 4 months after the MH370 disappearance, the MH17 was shot down from the sky over eastern Ukraine in July.
That was unbelievable.
You know, it was so surreal. And here I was going to the airport again for MH17. So it was just the most horrible year for airlines and for Malaysia as a whole. And the nation was in shock. And the airline was technically bankrupt and taken private and downsized. And then came COVID-19 pandemic. It was another shakeup. The airline was restructured again. But today, guess what? It has a growing cash balance of 5 billion. That's over 1 billion US dollars, 5 billion ringgit. Now, it has the means now. The management team is very young. I think they're all in their 40s or early 50s. They now have the money, they said, to invest, to upgrade on what they want to do on the customer services and improve on the quality of food, for example, because Malaysia Airlines is known for food, for its nasi lemak and for its satays and so on, you know? So, and then they hope that they can make it back to top 10 by 2030. Now, aviation analysts are saying that the airline has a shot, a better shot, without the interference, without any intervention from the government authorities. They probably could have done a lot better.
2014 was such a surreal year, and it's really hard to believe that so much time has passed. Thank you guys both so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Teresa.
Be sure to check out the stories by Mel and Olivia on CNA's YouTube channel and CNA.Asia. And a reminder that the TV episodes of CNA Correspondent air every Wednesday at 9:30 p.m. This episode was brought to you by Saya Nguyen, Clara Ong, Crispina Robert, Craig Dale, and myself, Teresa Tang. Thanks very much for your company.